It's live expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Is our number here, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. If you are investing in real estate and want more information, you should check out my new series, The Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate. Go to thinkglink.com and click on the red house, and it'll tell you all about it. Okay, we've got lines open. There's some people calling in. We're going to let that play out for just a moment. And in the meantime, I'm going to talk about the jobs data this week because I think it points to everything that's going wrong, or not going wrong, but still not really fixed, and yet some things that are looking a little bit better. But when it comes to unemployment, you know that I really feel like we can have a very, very strong real estate recovery, a true recovery, without having a lot of jobs. I just think if you don't have a job, you can't pay your mortgage. And these days, the banks aren't going to let you try either. So what happened with the jobs report this week? So we saw the jobs data with 169,000 increase in non-farm payrolls. It's just shy of 180,000. That was the consensus forecast. But that was after some sizable downward revisions. Remember, you might have recalled that we were hearing from ADP, which is never right, by the way, oh, we were going to get 223,000 new jobs. It wasn't anywhere close to that. But the jobless rate has ticked down nationally to 7.3%. Remember, a couple of years ago, it was over 10%? That was really frightening. And now it's 7.3%, which is great, except that the reason that the unemployment rate is going down is the labor force participation rate slid to 63.2%. That's the lowest level since August of 1978. And let's rewind what was happening in August of 1978. 1977 and 1978 were when women were really starting to move into the workforce. There was sort of a big push in World War II, and then the soldiers came home. And women, a lot of women got married and had babies, the beginning of the baby boom. But into the 70s, we started to see women go into the workforce in sort of a really big number. And the fact that we now have men and women in the workforce, and yet the labor force participation rate has shrunk back to where it was in 1978. Okay? 35 years ago, if my math serves me, that's really not so good. And for those of you who've been looking for a job, well, you know, this is really tough. Now, the percentage of the population that's employed, right? And this is an all-inclusive measure. Also fell to 58.6%, and that's the low end of the range. That's 1983. But what was 1983? Do you remember 1982? 1982, more interest rates went skyrocketing to like 18%. If you went to get a mortgage in 1982 and 1983, you were paying somewhere between 15 and 18% for that mortgage. We're at 4.75% this week, and people are freaking out. Try being back in the mid-1980s with the gas and oil crisis, and mortgage interest rates were like at 16%. That was terrifying. 1983, we were early in a recovery from a really bad recession. Where are we now? We're 4 years past, 4 years plus past the official end of the recession. And we're seeing labor participation rates that are right out of a very deep recession in the early 80s. So we're looking at kind of a ratio of where we were back in 1977. There's something wrong when we're talking about economically speaking, when we're talking about the economy, and we're talking about it in terms of 1977 and 1978. I don't know any other way to say it. It makes me very nervous. So what was good in the unemployment rate in the jobs report? Well, full-time jobs rose by 118,000, so that was good news. The part-time employment fell by 234,000. We want more people to have full-time jobs than part-time jobs. Full-time jobs have more longevity. They come with more benefits. People feel more secure in what they have, right? And then the U6, which is kind of what I call the fullest measure of unemployment, that's the part that, you know, takes into account discouraged workers and those who work part-time because they can't find full-time work and those who gave up and decided to stay home and be with their kids and those who decided to go back to school. All of that changed and fell a little bit from 14% to 13.7%. So ticked down 0.3. Not bad. So what else might be going on with unemployment? Well, here's something that you may have heard about. The porn industry, and yes, I just said the porn industry. The porn industry, part of the motion picture industry, had a bit of a trouble last month. And you may have read that two workers were diagnosed with HIV. And it basically froze everything going on in that industry. And so this month's jobs data reported that a record 22,000 jobs in the motion picture industry disappeared. There's a shortfall. And some reports, and this is according to Barron's, some reports attribute this to a temporary work stoppage in the adult film business, which, if that's true, could contribute to a rebound in job growth in September. So that's sort of interesting. You know, I don't even know how where to go with that. But there was that 22,000 lost jobs in the motion picture industry is actually a very, very significant number. And if that is actually because of the adult film work stoppage, that is another conversation to be had. But anyway, the August employment data wasn't the worst, and it wasn't the best, and it certainly wasn't anywhere near what we were hoping for. And this is now directly going to have an impact on what the Federal Reserve Bank is going to do, right? The Fed said that they would start withholding the $85 billion that they're spending each month to keep interest rates super low. They were going to start pulling back on that in September, or when the unemployment rate, the official unemployment rate, hit 7%. And then we saw Ben Bernanke over the last few months kind of hedge on it, saying that he thought maybe we weren't going to see so much pulling back, and he wasn't really sure that the unemployment rate at 7% was actually a true reflection of what's going on in the industry and in with employment. And so he had his own concerns. But it seems like the Fed might start to pull back. And what is going to happen when that happens is really interesting. We're already starting to see what's going to happen in the housing industry. So the housing industry finally has had a great spring, right? We had a limited number of houses on the market. We saw home prices zoom up. We saw homes get sucked off the market so fast. I mean, it's hard to believe that there were homes that sat on the market for 2 and 3 years, right? 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, nobody wanted to buy anything. And then the end of last year and into the beginning of this year, wow. I mean, like, homes went on the market and vaporized. All kinds of closings happened, and home prices went up. And part of the reason for that was was super low interest rates and people realizing that these things are going to tick up and they're not going to be around. Well, what's happened now that we've had 2 or 3 months where mortgage interest rates have been up a point and a quarter, 1 to 1.5% over where they were, and we're already hearing reports of how everything is kind of ground to a halt in some pieces of the market. So investors who still have cash are out there, or who don't actually need the money because they're the ones who get all the loans these days easily, they're out there still buying. But first-time buyers, who should be a very significant part of the marketplace right now, are not. And they're not because they can't get the loans. and because interest rates are jumping up. So it doesn't really help when I tell you that mortgage interest rates in 1982 were 16%, or even when I bought my first house in 1989 and I paid, you know, 11.75%, or that historically over the last 50, 60 years, mortgage interest rates have averaged about 7%, or even that, you know, since 1993, when mortgage interest rates fell below 6% for the first time in whenever. The average has been 5%. What matters in everybody's minds for first-time buyers is that they're out there looking at properties to buy, worried about their jobs, having mortgage interest rates jump up a little bit, and not feeling like they can qualify, that they have what it takes to be able to buy a house in this marketplace, that they're getting priced out. And that's a really serious situation. We don't want first-time buyers to be in that situation. We don't want anybody to feel like they're priced out of the market. Not now. Not when we're this early into a recovery. And I mean that even though we're 4 years into the recovery, it's early days. Employment has not rebounded. We're still missing millions of jobs. There are probably 8 million Americans to 10 million Americans who are still underwater with their mortgages or nearly at par. And the FHFA is about to go out with some sort of a huge announcement talking about HARP 2.0 and how many people still qualify for it and still need help. Not quite the picture of a recovery. However, it is the picture of an opportunity to build wealth for the next 20 to 30 years. It absolutely is. All right, let's take your calls, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I want to talk about the economy, houses, mortgages, buying, selling, investing, and all of the different things that we talk about on the show. Lines are wide open, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Follow me on Twitter, at Glink. It's 1218 on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. It's 1224, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online all the time, the website, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. And if you click on the red house, you will find out about my new ebook and webinar series called Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate, that will help you get started building a real estate empire of your very own. I'm confident of that. You can also follow me on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Just before the holiday, federal regulators proposed a new rule that is going to make mortgage lending standards a lot less restrictive. I don't know if you've been following what's going on here, but there has been a huge uproar about how much control the federal government wants to have on banks so that banks don't get ahead of themselves like they did in 2006 and 2007 and 2008. And we end up in a situation where we have, you may remember this, the housing crisis. And so one of the things that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is trying to do is to change around the qualified residential mortgage rule. And this new rule, which was actually released jointly by six government agencies, right, was really cheered. I mean, it was like joyful. If you could have seen the press releases that came out kind of heralding these new rules versus what has been being pushed by the government. Like the government said, we don't want 30-year fixed rate loans anymore. We want banks to only make loans with a 20% down payment. So can you imagine first-time buyers, as I just said, are already having a terrible time qualifying for mortgages under some of the new rules that are out there. They don't have the credit history and all the rest. And so there's been a huge backlash. The original rules went up for comment, and just thousands and thousands and thousands of people and institutions and organizations and companies stepped forward and said, these rules are just going to make a muck of it. And so, in fact, they got over 10,000 comments since 2011 from banks, securitizers, consumer groups, member of Congress, and other stakeholders. I mean, 10,000 comments is a lot of comments. Usually these rules might get several hundred comments, maybe 1,000, but 10,000 comments in a year and a half is a lot. Anyway, the new rules are going to be much less strict. And you're going to, and I know that there's the other side saying, well, we don't have, you know, strict rules. This is going to cause a problem in itself. But listen, if somebody's saying to you, you can only buy a house with 30% down, that could take 25 years for the typical American family to save 30% for a down payment of a home. It's just, that isn't going to be workable for the economy. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions, only on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
35 on News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink. Thanks for joining me today as we rebuild America one house at a time. The number 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online, the website, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Don't forget to sign up for the free weekly newsletter when you're there. Click on the red house. Take a look at my Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate series, 18 parts. And join us online. You can email me questions at thinklink.com. All right, 36 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. Phil joins me on the line. Hi, Phil.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. What can I do for you today?
I was going to ask you about the advantages and disadvantages of seller financing, owner financing, if we have someone who may not be able to get quite enough money from the bank on a house on the water. Up in North Carolina, up in a creek, you know, kind of protected mm-hmm. from hurricanes and so forth, but you have your own boat dock and really nice situation.
So are you selling and moving out of the area? Are you going to be in the neighborhood? Where are you going when you sell this house?
It's just a second home due to my wife's parents
mm-hmm.
having been an inheritance.
Okay, and so is it occupied now?
No.
Okay. So, who is coming to buy it? Is this a young couple that's going to make it their home, or is this a second house?
It's a couple with a maybe 35, 38 years old with three small children, one 9 years old, the other one maybe six, the other one maybe 2 or 3 months old.
Okay, so a young family, they're in their mid-30s, and it sounds like they're going to look to make this their full-time residence. So
right.
What happened, you know, so they obviously went to try and get a mortgage and they couldn't quite qualify. Is that what happened? They don't have enough down payment?
That's what it's looking like right now. They're still checking into some things, but I'm thinking if they run short.
Okay.
We have considered the advantages of owner financing, you know, if they were to fail on payments for whatever reason, bankruptcy or the loss of job or illness, whatever the reason later on, you know, we'll be able to take the house back.
Right. So owner financing is a really interesting option, and I talk about it in my Intentional Investor series because there are some real significant pluses and some real significant minuses to it. And understanding how those kind of come together is super important because you've got to protect yourself. So obviously the pro of doing it is the buyers you like get in, you get to sell the house, and transfer ownership, and you develop a regular stream of income at a much higher interest rate than you'd be able to get on your money almost anywhere else other than in the stock market and only if it goes well.
Right.
So a lot of people who do this really like that. The negatives, the risks that you take on are that they stop paying and then you have to go through a formal eviction process to get them out. And in that process, they may not take care of the house. They may damage the property just out of spite. And it could be a long time coming where you wouldn't have any income from the property, maybe as much as it could be a year or a year and a half if the eviction doesn't quite take and you have to go back and do all these different things. And so there are some serious issues that go along with it. Now, I like the idea of owner financing better than I like the idea of an installment contract, where
right.
they're buying the property sort of over time, piece by piece. and control kind of transfers usually at the, they wanted at the control to transfer at the beginning, you want it to transfer at the end. And that makes me more nervous than if you had actually, you know, done it this way where you're, they have, they own it, but you have the first lien on the property. Now, another risk is that you have to actually do the closing in a proper way, and then the lien has to be recorded so that the world is put on notice that you actually have a first lien on this property, and they can't go out and get another mortgage that would then take precedence over you. And so you need to have a real estate attorney who's going to drop the mortgage document. I know you said they don't have any down payment cash. That's a concern, of course, because then you're taking on almost 100% risk.
Well, they may have a sizable down payment. We already discussed it that far. I just was kind of wanting to be prepared, you know, in the case that they're not able to get enough loan money, and we don't want to drop the price very much.
Right. Well, if you're not, if the, so the first question is the house actually worth what you're asking for it?
Oh yes. Yes.
So what are you asking for the property?
Could be around $395,000.
Okay, and do you know that other homes in the area have sold for around that are similar?
Yes.
Okay, so the property is worth what you're asking for, so if they have down payment money, it's unclear to me why they wouldn't actually want to go out and get a real mortgage rather than dealing with the owner. Because for them, you're dealing with, you don't get a clean break. You always have an owner who's continued to be tied to the property and who may have an emotional tie that you know, has them stopping by time and time again. So from their point of view, there are pluses and negatives as well, just like from your side, there are pluses and negatives. And the real question is, you know, is this going to be enough of a break for them that they're going to want to do it, right? So you're not going to charge them points and fees. They're going to not pay maybe as high an interest rate. Do you want to lock in your money for 30 years, 10 years, 5 years? How long do you want to give them to be able to qualify until you want to get all that cash? And then you have to plan for what happens if something happens to you, and what happens to this loan, and who inherits it, and who stays in touch with them, and you have to set up the regular payments, and what happens if they get late. I mean, they're all different kinds of things to consider on both sides. Now, have they made an offer yet?
I have an excellent job, but he has not been on the job that long, and then the financial institution is probably waiting for a little more time, maybe a couple of months, to see how, his time on the job, how it panned out, but he does have an excellent job.
Did he make an offer for the property?
Yes.
Okay. And did you accept it?
Not quite yet.
Why not?
We want to come back a little higher because we think he's too low.
Okay. Well, you have a buyer. They're interested. You don't want to wait too long. But I think, what did the financing contingency say on the offer? Did they include a financing contingency?
No, it was a verbal offer so far. We want to consider it yet or not. It's a verbal offer, not in writing, and not that many folks really. This just actually put it on the market. Not many people have seen it, but we're thinking that when more and more people see the layout and the way it is, other people are going to want it. And it just stands to reason that looking at the other areas, other properties in the area, then more people are going to want this one.
Okay, so I'm just going to tell you a little story and the punchline. So we had some neighbors in the neighborhood in which I live. And we had always had our eye, along with another family, on this property. And we said to the guy, listen, if you're ever going to sell, and we'd lived next to him at 15 years at that point, you know, if you're ever going to sell, let me know. And so he came to us and he said, okay, we're going to sell our house. And for you, the special low price of $900,000, which was about twice what the property was worth. And we just sort of gasped and went, really? And it's 2008, right, or 2007, and the world is starting to crumble, and he thinks that his property is worth twice as much, or at least that we think it's so valuable we're going to pay for it. And so we just We thought about coming back and making an offer with the neighbors on the other side, and in the end, we decided not to. But they ended up going back on their own, and they made an offer for about $800,000. And the guy shopped the offer. It was really well above what that property was worth, and the guy shopped the offer around, and the other neighbors who made the offer, they withdrew the offer. Because by the time he came back a week or two later and said, I guess I will take your offer, because he couldn't get anything better, they pulled it, and he didn't have anything. And the property sat on the market for 5 years, and he finally sold it for about $500,000.
Right.
So the lessons that I want to share with you today about this story, which is true, is number one, your first offer is usually your best offer. And in a market like this where there aren't that many homes on the market and people are looking for homes, there's usually a lot of competition. And so if you or your agent has done the appropriate job of publicizing that your property's for sale with signage online, on Zillow, on Realtor.com, it's listed, you've done a website for it, and all the rest. If you've done everything you're supposed to do for marketing, that means that there's a fair number of people who already know that it's on the market, and they're talking to their buyers who are out there looking for property. And if you've got an immediate offer or somebody who's come in, you want to jump on it and see what's going on. Now, it's an inherited property for you. It's a second home, not a primary residence. And somebody who's going to buy it, you want to make sure that they actually have the qualifications. I'm not saying sell it to somebody who can't afford it. I'm saying think about what it is that makes this property unique. Go out and try to garner as much attention and interest in the property right away, and then see what you get. But don't always think that the next offer that comes along is just going to be that much better, and that your house is favorably, it's so much more favorable than the other homes in the neighborhood. And maybe it is, but then that would say to me, I don't think you're doing an appropriate job of marketing it. So you've got to give it some time, for sure, a couple of weeks, if that's what it is. But the markets are pretty much moving quickly, and I want to make sure that you don't let a serious offer go by dragging your heels on making a counter offer. You've got to get in there and see what this is, if this is really going to be the right offer or not. The neighbor the story that I told you, he didn't want to engage with us. In his head, this was sort of somewhat an inflated price point, and he was just going to, buy it, and we were going to pay that, and the answer was, well, we really weren't going to pay that. And so I think when you're considering this offer, go back, make a serious counter, see what they have to do, see what you can do to get it sold, because the second offer or the third offer, whenever it is they come along, may not be as good as the first one. And I think any agent worth her salt or his salt will tell you that over the years, what they've learned is the first offer is generally the best offer. 404-872-0750 is our number here at the station. 1-800-WSB-TALK. Happy to take your calls. We have some lines open. We're going to come back and take a few more of your questions. I think we're going to also talk a little bit more about a conversation we started last week about raising money smart kids. And this is in honor of my son Alex's 18th birthday, which is tomorrow. We're very excited. But with this comes all kinds of interesting things that you probably haven't thought of, and some even I hadn't thought of. Having a conversation with one of my good friends who's an attorney, whose daughter turned 18 earlier this year, and some things that she learned, I'm going to share those and some other things coming up next. And, of course, taking your questions, 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America One House at a Time on News Talk WSB. Sunday morning rain is falling. Hey, it's 12:55 on the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Jason joins me on the line now. Hey, Jason, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's going on?
We're in the process of buying a new house. This is our fourth or fifth. We're in our mid-40s. And I had the offer for 95% finance and 5% down. It added about a 0.75 point, I think, to the loan. And just debating on whether or not to do that. I've got the money to make a 20% down payment, but I was kind of looking at keeping the cash to be able to you know, fund my emergency fund and to catch up on our Ross. And I might be having to buy a new car or going to buy a used car, but one I can pay cash for and leave that cash available and get your opinion on that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Let's talk about the car first. There are some amazing lease deals now. I normally am not a fan of leases because I think it's kind of throwing away money. But $30,000 cars are going for, you can get a $200 a month lease for 3 years. And so what that does for you is you end up spending about $7,000 versus the $30,000, and you're keeping your cash on hand for at least 3 years. So that's one thing to consider.
Okay.
And you'll have to put some down payment money there as well. But think about the car as sort of a different kind of thing. Now, I normally, as you probably know because you've listened to me for a while, when I buy a car, I keep it 10, 11 years, and my 11-year-old Honda minivan is now starting to have some problems.
We've got 2 15-year-old cars.
Yeah, so you're going to have to do something. So there are some options in terms of keeping cash. But, you know, the 5% down thing, what's the interest rate that they're giving you on that?
5.125, I believe.
You know, it's not a bad interest rate. It's a great historic interest rate, and it's doable, and someday that's going to feel cheap to you. You can always go in and refinance. But I think that having cash available is important. So depending on how quickly it would take you to rebuild your emergency fund, you know, you might try doing 10% down or the 20% to get you back to the under the 5% level, and just trying to build up the emergency cash separately. But I understand for Roth IRAs, you're starting to run out of time in the year. And I, you know, if you, that's a wonderful option. You're doing good things. You have good options in front of you with the money. I just don't like the idea of only 5% down on your house when you have other kinds of cash available to you.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
So.
Yeah, I've never done this before. I've never done one. We've always done at least 20% down. So this was the first time that was ever offered to me. So.
Well, it's, you know, if you said to me it was 2 years ago and you said I'm going to do 5% down and I get 3.5%, I'd say that's a no-brainer. At 5.125%, it might be a no-brainer 2 years from now if interest rates go up to 6%. If they drop down a little bit again, you'll have the chance to refinance. But the best rates will always go to people who have at least 20% down. So
right.
I think what you have to do is weigh the amount of money you have and what you're going to do with it. If you don't put it down on this property, and how quickly you'll be able to rebuild from your savings if you do. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink. We'll be back in a moment with more on News Talk WSB.